Hello again, wherever you are. Welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is the politics journalist Sam Mkokeli. Sam has been a reporter for 20 years and recently ended a three-year stint at Bloomberg, where he wrote about politics in South Africa and across the continent. Our discussion is part of a series I introduced last week with my chat with Pippa Green, the new ombudsman, looking at the media in South Africa, the state of the media, the challenges facing journalists, particularly as we approach the general elections on May the 8th. So we touched on a number of issues around local politics, a lot of focus on the ANC, the state of the ANC, the possibility of the ANC transforming itself into something new. And also just looking at the state of the press, the challenges facing journalists and the industry in South Africa today. He is also head of the Media Freedom Subcommittee at the South African National Editors Forum. So we did touch on issues around press freedom and the role of press, which he sees as being very important in supporting the democratic project in South Africa. So please now enjoy my chat with Sam. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Nick.
And thanks for your time today. It's nice to meet you.
Pleasure.
We've been talking for a couple of weeks now, but of course, you running around, and I understand you've now just left Bloomberg. How long were you working at Bloomberg for?
Almost 3 years.
Okay, as the politics editor, reporter.
As a senior reporter. The main responsibility is to explain the South African story to somebody who's not in South Africa, somebody who has money in South Africa or wants to put in or pull out money in South Africa. But then the whole ambit is I was the senior reporter for the whole continent to trying to link up
the
political economy. I mean, there have been exciting events in South Africa recently, in Nigeria going through an election.
Yeah.
So if you're not in South Africa or Nigeria and you've got money to put in Africa, so try and explain.
Just give the socio-economic and political context of the continent.
Yeah, I mean, really it's politics for business, but because I'm in South Africa and South Africa is the biggest and sophisticated economy. Somebody in Nigeria, they will tell you that their economy is way bigger than ours. But we still have South Africa.
Depends on the oil price,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, the most sophisticated, most modernized economy in Africa. Then they can come and argue with us.
Did you go up for the elections?
Unfortunately, I couldn't. But also, I mean, there's almost a clash in terms of the timing for it. I mean, the South African story is evolving right in front of you. It's thriller minute, you know.
And
you switch your attention for a second, and something has happened.
I was just like thinking now, where do I even start this conversation? Because it is such a, particularly now with all these commissions of inquiry. I mean, every day there's something for you to jump on, or at least more than one thing for you to jump on. So, I mean, how have you sort of negotiated just the last couple of years when it comes to following or trying to explain the politics, the political landscape of South Africa?
Geez, it's been crazy. It's been intense, really, the past 4 years. I mean, I remember the 2014 election. It's probably one of the most boring elections by our standards of the drama we've become used to. Because it was predictable.
Yeah.
quite
ANC 60%, DA 25%.
And then we went to a little lull and we thought things were a bit stable and less dramatic. And then we had the 2016 local election where Jesus came back. To a few cities in Johannesburg, Tswane, that came as a surprise to a whole lot of us.
Nelson Mandela Bay was the one that you would have predicted, perhaps, but Johannesburg
and Pretoria. I mean, so many people in the ANC were surprised. I mean, I remember at the results center, I was a whole lot of the ANC senior leaders, and they were so shocked.
Really?
What is it? Is it the method they use to calculate and split up the votes? Is it turnout? Is it what?
But they couldn't consider themselves as part of the problem then. I mean, their analysis was kind of...
If you've done it for so long and you got away with it, I mean, you're used to saying Nkandla is a white man's problem, and only the white people were concerned about the Nkandla scandal and the white-controlled media. I mean, people used to say such things, and they thought they would get away with it and forever, and that they were going to govern until Jesus came back, as they often claimed for a long time. And in 2016, and then just to use their metaphor, I mean, Jesus came back to these cities. I mean, that changed the game altogether.
Do you think that was then a contributing factor to the downfall of Jacob Zuma then?
No, of course, and completely.
Yeah.
The many people in the ANC realized that the 2019 elections, they had a big chance of falling below 50% if Jacob Zuma stayed on. And they had seen that almost 3 million people in 2016 stayed away from voting, and these are ANC voters historically. So they saw the writing on the wall, and that there were going to be problems. And then the other issues that came up, the more revelations around the corruption scandals associated with Jacob Zuma, the Guptas, and this is the ANC's general incompetence in the policy areas and the administration in government, and other societal problems, and it fled up going to the 2017 election. And that made Jacob Zuma's and the Zuma faction as campaign rather difficult. And that, starting from the 2016 electoral losses, I mean, the indications were there that it was downhill.
Something that had to change.
Yeah. So,
And I mean, and you were at that conference. I mean, you famously had a run-in with the I'm not sure if they were government state security officials or ANC security people. Did you ever find out who that was? That was.
I've tried not to go back to that incident, but at the same time, I've tried to go
back. I'm sorry about that.
It follows me, don't worry. I mean, sometimes I bring it back onto me. I remember at the beginning of the year, I was attending the ANC's manifesto launch, and I think, oh my goodness, I'm going to a public event, and there's going to be security and all the eyes on me. What do I do? And at the same time, I genuinely would love to meet the gentleman. I understand he was part of the state security. I mean, I'd like to do the South African thing of sitting across the table with him, have a cup of coffee, or he can have a beer, I'll have my water, and we'll talk about it. And I'd really would like to invite him to join this lifelong journey of fighting to protect our freedoms and freedom of the press. And I'd like to have a conversation with him about it. And I mean, the whole thing happened when I wanted to leave a press conference that was running horribly late, and we were really rounded up in a very open space, and with the sun baking down. And I'm saying to the gentleman, can somebody please let me go back to my desk? And Mr. Ramaphosa is terribly late, and I'm not going to do this. An hour into my time is quite important. I need just to go back. Please, somebody let me walk out. And they wouldn't. They kept blocking me and saying, no, you can't leave this press conference on your own. You must have a security marshalling you back to your workstation.
Yeah.
It's the whole culture. It's like heading animals.
Was that a new thing for you? I mean, you'd obviously covered previous ANC conferences, meetings, NECs, etc., etc. Was this the first time you'd confronted that?
No,
security apparatus control.
Now, it actually crept up in the past, in just the 5 years leading to Tunas and to the second term of the Zuma's head of term and as head of the ANC. We used to attend ANC conferences in Midrand, and I'm sure they chose that venue quite carefully, because the setup, they would keep us literally at bay. You would have to walk up the hill 500 meters to go to where everybody else was, and they would make sure there are enough security people to make sure that the journalists are kept at bay, because somebody might just do something dangerous, like greeting you.
Yeah, ask a question.
Or slipping you a piece of information. a little note.
Answer a question.
Or to tell you to get lost. So they didn't want us to interact.
At
so
all.
Funny. We see people meeting journalists now in dark corners and under trees. You know, it's just a beautiful big garden with big trees, and so you'd find people in
behind the bushes,
exchanging information with journalists. And then they perfected it at NASREC. Mm. That this fence, and that really kept us at bay. Like you would put a fence for head of cattle and make sure that they don't cross the line.
So they really put you in your place.
Yeah, they did.
I mean, what does that say, really? I mean, for an organization that, I mean, obviously fought for our freedoms, for all of our freedoms, and has gone on record a number of times to say, you know, they believe vehemently in the freedom of the press and the role of the press in protecting a democracy, and yet they always seem, you know, every now and again there's an incident where that seems to be unclear.
Look, there are two fascinating things for me about it. Let me start with the first one, what it means. The ANC is still in the bush, culturally, and in its the way it operates. It's still that liberation movement that was not allowed to operate in an open society. People are not supposed to show, for example, their ambition. You're not supposed to lift your, put your hand up and say, I've got the skills and I want to serve as the president of the ANC. That is seen as being an ANC, and you're flouting the movements.
Protocols.
The protocols and all those cultural things about the ANC itself. So the culture, is also very pretentious, because people do put their hands up without actually saying that. So it's still stuck in its terminology and in its operations generally. So the second one comes to how it relates to the media, because they think that if they put up a fence, it becomes a solid physical barrier that somebody cannot send you a WhatsApp message across that fence from inside the conference hall and tell you what is going on. And so they think that
They see you in the corner there, they've got control of you.
Yeah. They think their own comrades, as they call each other, are not interested in playing the media game, and they do not. You know, we just need the people to be rounded up physically and not be spoken to. And then there's also then the real aspect of it, where it's actually very dangerous, is this talk of the media freedom and this commitment to democracy, yet you still find security playing a big role in the key decisions around operations and who walks around and who goes where and things like that. That it moves on from actions and interactions like that into the policy arena, where the ANC finds something like a media appeals tribunal, where journalists could be sent to jail, and they put together a whole policy, and it became a draft legislation that was passed in parliament. It needed just a signature of Jacob Zuma from 2013. And now that bill, as far as we know, as the Editors Forum in South Africa, is gathering dust on the desk of our President Ramaphosa. And it's such a draconian piece of legislation that whistleblowers can go to jail for doing a good job to protect this democracy. And it has serious implications, and not just for people like you and I, but it's got problems for a trade unionist who wants to raise an issue at work. It has implications for somebody who might want to raise issues about gender abuse and other evils in society. If they came across a certain document that the authorities didn't want shared with the public, they could be seriously faced with the legal ramifications and the possibility of going to jail. I mean, a piece like that certainly does not belong in a democracy like ours. You wouldn't be surprised if the National Party government put together that. But I mean, the African National Congress, I mean, even entertaining such an idea and pushing it all the way to almost being a law. It needs only the president's signature. And we had a conversation with Mr. Ramaphosa in his towards the end of his first 100 days in office.
This was as a you're a representative of SANEF in this context.
That's right.
You're actually, is it the chair of the Media Freedom Committee of SANEF?
That's right.
Yeah, just to clarify.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we asked him, Mr. Ramaphosa, and say, please, just get rid of the damn
away.
Thing.
Put it in the dustbin.
Yeah. If you have any, if you're disagreeing with us, we're happy to hear your side of things. And if you want, take it to the Constitutional Court. And we have no doubt, and they will tell you to get lost because this thing is just not in line with the values and the spirit of the Constitution. Mm. And he said it would receive his attention and a year later, and he's not done anything about it. So you think that he wouldn't sign it into law because it's got serious implications for democracy and also economic investment into South Africa. If South Africa is now regarded as a democracy that is slipping in some way or form, and people will look at that and say, okay, if they are taking away freedom from journalists and whistleblowers, what happens to my property rights, and what guarantee do I have that there's going to be stability in this country, and also my investment, will it be protected? So it might just go against this drive Mr. Ramaphosa is on to bring in investment.
It would be a contradiction to Tumamina and that whole sort of regeneration of the ANC that he's trying to now foment, right?
Of course. It goes against everything that Dada Nelson Mandela stood for. I mean, Mr. Ramaphosa is known as that he was as supposedly the preferred heir to Madiba. Madiba had made a public statement back in the 90s about his preference for his successor as being Mr. Ramaphosa. And many people see him as the guy who really embodies the Mandela-ness and the South African-ness and the Rainbow Nation-ness, and most importantly, constitutionalism. He's the guy who led the negotiations and the crafting of this really beautiful constitution. So it's not enough that we assume that he wouldn't sign it into law. I mean, we can only go by his official decisions, and he has not taken a decision or acted in that regard.
Hmm. You wonder why a decision hasn't been taken one way or the other, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, maybe politically, and also the strategy is to not to bother sleeping dogs and things like that. But we can't go by that in a constitutional democracy. We have to judge administration based on their actions and their policies and the laws they uphold and respect. Mm-hmm. Maybe he sees in terms of the priorities he has, there's probably far more important issues to deal with, the Eskom crisis and the economic crisis broadly, and the issues of a broad political leadership and ethical leadership in both the public and in the private sectors. I mean, there's a whole lot of things. We are a nation in crisis, so maybe just looking at some sort of order or hierarchy of the problems.
Of order of business, yeah. Yeah, Sam, I mean, there's so much. I want to get to a couple of these issues as we go along. I just want to go a little bit back to the beginnings of your career, or because you've now been a journalist for 20 years or so, and you kind of went straight into journalism from school. What sort of put you on that path? Where did maybe I can just ask you a little bit about your family and where you grew up?
Yeah, look, it was a fluke in how I became a journalist at a very, very young age. I grew up in rural Eastern Cape, and it's a beautiful village just outside East London. It's a beautiful port city. The village in the district is Ncerha Villages, and I come from one of the villages. There's fourth village called Village 4. And I draw a whole lot of inspiration throughout my life so far from this beautiful village of proud Africans, people who do not have much, but they have pride, and also they have hope of a better tomorrow. And sometimes when I go back and appreciate where I come from and where they come from, where they still are, and it gives me a great sense of pride and just watching the resilience that is in them, and despite their very difficult station in life. So I graduated from a high school over there, and I had been used to playing with a camera, and my parents had bought me a camera as a present, maybe the age 13, and I'd been associated with people in the village, and also uncles who could take a few snaps here and there with a little point and shoot of muck and dirt.
Like those little Instamatic kind of things?
Yeah, yeah. So at school, I mean, I was the school's photographer unofficially, okay. So I would take pictures here and there. But I mean, the dream was to become a civil engineer. I was a math and science kid. My math grades weren't too great, and so I had to go into college after a matric and just to do a bridging course into civil engineering that was supposed to help me. I just couldn't draw. I hated civil engineering as a last point. I just couldn't draw. And had this
technical drawings.
Yeah, I was just fascinated with the taking pictures. So I would go to the lectures and carrying this massive camera with a zoom lens, and I was rushing and itching to go out into the streets to take the next photograph. I remember when I wrote my technical drawing exam, and I couldn't leave the exam room without, there was a cut of time. You had to wait in for at least 30 minutes before you hand in your paper.
Oh, right.
I had nothing to draw. I knew that I'm not doing this for the formality. And I handed back a blank drawing sheet with my student number.
Man.
And the invigilators looked at me and said, "This guy must be mad. What is it doing?" And I just left, and I went to take in a picture. It was a front page in the local newspaper in East London, on the Daily Dispatch the following day.
What was the photo?
I came across an accident, a car accident along the way from from college, and I rushed to the newspaper and said, "Guys, I've got a picture, and you need to see this." And so I got used to submitting photos on freelance. It was a sport or it was a social activity around East London, the city, the village life, and the townships around, and I got used to that, and I taught myself to write effectively, because the pictures had to go with the
caption, yeah,
and a bit of information. I'd support it in a handwritten note or a story and say, "This is the information," and then increasingly they let me into the newsroom, and they gave me a computer for an hour. I could type up my own story, and I couldn't really type, so I would just type in with one finger and slowly and submit the information, and I got used to typing and writing. It was a hard process, but then I would become a regular freelancer and part of the Daily Dispatch community. And then
what year was this then?
In 1998 and 99.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I got to cover some interesting aspects of South African life evolving at the time.
Yeah.
Which was a new democracy and the 1999 elections.
And that was quite a progressive newspaper, wasn't it, in a sense, in the sort of context of the white media, wasn't it, the Daily Dispatch? I mean, I think they did have quite a good reputation, or was that...
Oh, yeah. I mean, Dispatch is still, till this day, is a strong institution in South Africa. You'd remember it had the brave editor, Donald Woods, who helped and supported Steve Biko iconically, and many others. I mean, he took a strong stand against the apartheid
government. The security forces.
I mean, he wrote incredibly strong editorials and columns. I mean, till this day, I'd like to see more South Africans writing as powerfully as he did. I mean, he'd write this one stunning column that was in the Dispatch in the 70s, the need for the release of political prisoners, and the apartheid government kept giving him the middle finger, saying, "Who cares if we do this?" And then he wrote back to them and talking quite powerfully and saying, "This is the person who's going to care." And he listed a whole lot of them, and with a powerful punchline as the tail or the sting of things, saying, "The whole bloody world will rejoice," and in line with the downfall of the terrible apartheid system. So till this day, I mean,
so that was very much part of the philosophy or the energy of the paper when you were working there as well, the new South Africa.
It was slightly different, I felt, when I look back now. I mean, it became a local paper that cared about what was going on in East London. But it since regained that old standing in the
paper. Voice, yeah.
Yeah, that punches way above its weight. Mm. It has won so many awards nationally in recent years, beating the best papers in the country because of a powerful kind of journalism. And they've sort of taken this tone of civic journalism and caring about what's happening in their doorstep. And actually, it's often the best way to do political journalism. And when you're showing the failures of the social welfare system, healthcare, and it actually portrays it beautifully beyond the criticism of the rallies or the leadership choices. And it actually explains the impact of the the bad choices people make and choosing political parties or particular leaders to become ministers and things like that. So that was really my path into the whole career. And I've gone into work for different newspapers and different cities across the country, and really have been blessed to have experienced the evolution of this a greater nation, and also to experience how South Africa loses its way. You'd remember coming in 94, there was this excitement about the euphoria, and then after Mandela, it moves into a different kind of a path where economically things are looking so good, and we growing around 5% on average during the Mbeki years. I mean, the economy is humming beautifully, although there was still the problem of unemployment, but there was a great sense of hope, and we're done beautiful things, whether it was in the sporting arena, we'd won the Nations Cup, and we knew that in football we're a strong country, and in rugby, and we'd done great, and we went on in 2007. So despite the problems that we've experienced in leadership, the AIDS problems, and in many others issues where we felt we could have done better in. And then came the Zuma years, and really a painful, a wasted a decade in so many ways, and on so many levels. So to live through, and really you have a front row seat to all those things, and to watch the evolution of the post-Mandela South Africa, and how that rainbow loses and fades out.
Yeah.
And
it's become a bit grey.
Yeah, not just a bit, and really, I mean, we have lost quite a bit. And I had a conversation with the Minister of Communications recently, Estella Ndabeni, who had tried to block a journalist from covering an event.
Yes, it was the Manifesto launch, Eastern Cape Manifesto launch, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And she prevented the camera from...
Her mitigating statement, having owned up that reaction and the actions were irrational and they were bad, and she profusely apologized, and she explains that it was a reflex reaction to what was going on. She wasn't thinking as a minister, and I said, I get all of that, but for me, I want to see South Africans behaving in a democratic manner in their very private lives and in their very, very private capacities. That's where we want to measure each one of us as South Africans. That's how you get a democracy deeply rooted, where my interaction with you, it's become naturally democratic. If there's a conflict, we must naturally resolve it in a democratic manner. In our private lives, even before we put on our official hats. So we've lost quite a bit in terms of the idealism of a peaceful a nation. And then when you look at it, when you look at the crime stats we get often, and that about how violent our society has become. So if leaders and professionals naturally in
turn
their reflex
violence actions,
you tend to violence, then you have to imagine somebody else who has a very different social, economic, psychological setup and how they suppose to resolve a conflict. So we have lost quite a bit in terms of the attempt to deepen democracy as a way of governance. And not just democracy and freedom for its sake, but democracy is a way to mitigate and go through the difficult challenges that we have so that we can achieve social justice, economic justice. We can truly see people who come from my background and people who come from a very difficult, even worse of a background, can at least have the hope that there is a system that can actually help them realize their goals and their dreams. And not just for themselves, their dreams for their kids. We see the education system in South Africa failing. The school I went to, 20 years ago where I graduated. And now produces far less graduates than when I was there. Now, in a democratic system, the school is going backwards. Yeah. It pains me when I see, and it's not just the school, there's so many other, when I travel and crisscross the country, it actually explains the inequality in South Africa. So if somebody I'd grown up with did not get my lucky break and they escape out of that poverty trap, so their kids are going to grow up in the village, they're going to carry on with that vicious cycle of poverty, and then they're not going to get a better education, and they're not going to escape. It's in government documents that the National Development Plan that was produced 5 years ago or so, it was an attempt to create a policy that, moving from a diagnosis that for an 18-year-old girl to escape poverty, they would need to be 60 to end the old age social grant for them to escape poverty. At age 18, they don't have a good enough education to get a job, so they are not employable, and they're not going to get a good job their entire lives until they get the old age grant that is right now just below 2,000 rands. That's the only way for them to escape poverty. No, it repeats a vicious and painful cycle.
And 2,000 rand seen as an escape from poverty.
It's below 2,000 rands. I mean, that is. And with that old age grant, a typical gogo has 10 mouths to feed.
Well, yeah.
And these are the kids who are going through this very difficult education system that in some ways produces an inferior quality grades. If you look at maths and science in terms of producing usable skills. So there's so many people in South Africa, and they're soldiering on but I mean, they are trapped in a poverty trap for generations. We're reproducing. I mean, even the spatial planning. The people in my village have to travel 40 kilometers to town to look for a job.
There's it, yeah.
And so it locks them completely out of any chance of coming across an economic opportunity. And so we've got so many deep problems. It's not going to take a Ramaphosa to solve the problem. It's not going to take 5 years, 10 years to undo the recent problems. Then you go back to the legacy problems of the apartheid and colonial history. In so many ways, we are trapped in a very, very difficult situation. Despite the one aspect of our DNA, which is the resilience of South Africans. But that is not enough. I mean, we want, as journalists, to be telling this story. And for me, the one story that I haven't been able to tell is the story of South African inequality, its causes, its effect on a daily basis, and how it intersects with the racial issue. How the economic your economic station seems to be the one issue that determines your future, and it is a very interesting proxy for me. And it's one of the issues that I think the media industry, we caught up in the daily battles and the big stories of scandal. This really is, it's dramatic scandals that we're eating it. We're not even.
There's no chance to scratch a little bit below the surface and look at a bigger kind of picture.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the typical South African who's throwing their hands in the air and saying, geez, the shocking scandals coming out of the Commission of Inquiry into state capture. I think that this is the worst they have seen. It is not the worst they have seen. If you look at the reports of the Auditor General, every year there's shocking stats about money meant for bulk infrastructure, for water, sanitation.
And at the municipal level particularly.
Yeah, and that money doesn't reach the areas it's supposed to. And so often you would see incidents where there's police shooting and they killing protesters who are protesting over public system services failure. And these things are not even being connected, and these dots are not being linked up. But how the Guptas allegedly stole so much, and this is what the consequences of the failure and poor policing, and this is why the people are dying in hospitals and other things are because of this. And also, the Guptas are very dramatic. They perfected corruption in terms of the allegations that we're looking at. But when you look at the lower levels, the provincial layer of government, and provinces like your Free State and Northern Cape and Northwest, and pretty much all the provinces. And then you mention municipal governance. A whole lot of money is wasted there, and it gets squandered. And we're not even talking about that. And if we're not talking about that, we're not going to fix it. And we're going to keep thinking that the Guptas were the worst criminals we've had to deal with. And yet we live with them every day, and they abuse state resources every single day. And we don't think that they are the Guptas. We don't even get to dealing with the systemic nature of the failures.
How do you explain that, though? Because I've also wondered a bit about that. You know, of course, you talk about the last 10 years, we talk about the Guptas, but, you know, that's not the only issue and the only problem and that we face. Is it a consequence of the structure of our media industry? Is it a consequence of the state of the media industry that it has become, if I may choose the word, it's become easy to become sensationalist, and it's easy to find those stories that are, I suppose, at one level newsworthy and important to tell, but only tell a fraction of a bigger picture?
Look, in the media landscape and how it's evolved over the years is very interesting, and it's in how it's really the political economy of the media and how that affects how we cover these things and how people are informed and consume the news. And in some aspects of the media, you see some examples of newsrooms and thinning out due to the difficult economic situation. I mean, if you look at newspapers, I used to work for a Business Day, and I was its news editor. And then 10 years ago, I became its political editor. And it used to be a big newspaper. It's still a powerful voice. But in practical terms, and the print product is half what it was 10 years ago. It's just an industry that has not recovered from the global recession we had 10 years ago. And also things that have changed in terms of
digitization
and advertising spend and ways. So the industry has changed quite a bit, and we've not really come out with a formula to counter that. But I mean, this is the reality we have, and this is where we are. So some areas and that used to be covered, but areas of public policy, areas of economics. I mean, our problem are largely about the economics, and there hasn't been much investment from the newsrooms into that area. When you're understanding, look, trying to follow the Jacob Zuma era, you can't just look at it in terms of the power battles, and you have to look at the power battles, but for what? What has been the impact of that? Then you move away, you still cover the economics, we cover the central bank, we cover the broad business, and the corporate sector gets covered broadly. But also the social side of things and how that is affected. When you talk about education, it is not just the matric results, it is about the skills development and what kind of skills are required by industry, and what skills the education sector is providing for this kind of industry. So these are the areas that don't get much play in the newsrooms. And you're seeing a very high concentration as well of news titles. I mean, if you look at the Independent group, for example, a very once very powerful group, where you see now the content out of the Cape Argus is no different to the content out of the Cape Times or the Pretoria News. So you start asking a question around the diversity.
So the front page kind of looks the same in each city.
Just a general across, you find some examples, and sometimes it's just the natural, and also you want to give space for people who take such decisions to make the decisions and make mistakes around it. But sometimes there are some nefarious motives around it that relate to the ownership of that the newspaper group. I mean, there's very, very serious concerns shared by the public about how the owner of that newspaper...
The PIC money and all of that.
Yeah, and the PIC money and how he controls newspapers. And media freedom is really strong in that group, and there have been serious examples of editors quitting in a serious exodus, and some have been fired in very inappropriate circumstances, and that really bother us as the Editors Forum and as journalists broadly where journalists don't have their voice to speak out against what's happening in the group itself. But if journalists cannot talk about what's happening around their immediate environment, how can we expect journalists to represent anyone in society? And India, the independent group is not the only one. I mean, we've done a study as a SANEF with the Vets University looking at incidents of inappropriate interference in the editorial space, which is supposed to be sacrosanct. And the interference is by people from the corporate sector in the media spaces, and they really making lives difficult for editors and telling them what news to cover, how to run their business. And so that bothers us a great deal. And
how do they do that? Is that sort of threatening advertising spend and unless you don't do this or that? Or, I mean, how does the corporate sector influence a newsroom?
Now, the primary one is indirect influence by the corporate sector and the newsroom, but the direct interference and inappropriate interference in newspapers is by media bosses and owners and corporate managers in newspapers. They would tell an editor, we don't like how you're writing about this particular company. Please stop doing that. It could be something as direct as that, or sometimes some inferred threats that if you carry on in this manner or that manner, will act in this manner. So that puts editors in a very uncomfortable a situation. But I mean, editors are editors, and they must edit, and they have to withstand
that. They must stand up for the integrity of their media organization.
Absolutely. I mean, we're not in the journalism field because it's a wonderful job. It's something bigger than that. It is a great craft. It really is a great craft. But I mean, we have a duty beyond our basic relationship with our employers. Our primary concern should be about fighting for this great ideals about humanity and human rights and South Africanness. And so if it means that you lose your job along the way, we should expect that. We really enjoying a democracy that people died for. And this journalist, this democracy was fought for by people who were prepared to use arms and to face arms. And were prepared to lay down their lives, and some laid down their lives, and some of them were journalists, and they used their pen to fight for a free democracy. So we have to be imbued with a bigger sense and a bigger sense of duty around it. If it means that your relationship with your employer or your boss as an editor, it should be easy to say so be it.
What if you could look back over the last 20 years, what would be the most significant story that you have been able to cover and write about?
I have yet to write my best piece or my biggest scoop. Really, half my career has been spent in the office, in the newsroom, basic editing or news editing and political editing or writing opinion pieces on breaking news and political decisions. And but really, that pales into insignificance when I look at the history we're looking at. We've had great journalists and your agri clusters and your Percy Qobozas and people who come from the drum generation. And I mean, that's the golden era for me. And
that is where you draw inspiration from, you would say, those kinds of ideals then.
Absolutely. I mean, when I come across what people used to write in the early 1900s and how they used the power of the pen, and whether they were writing for Izimvoza Bantsundu or Isolezwe, and the kind of issues and the disagreements and the nature of the discourse around whether the ANC was taking the right path
even back then.
Back then, or not.
Yeah.
And people challenging each other in the industry. Mm. So I mean, I've done some stories that people liked, and they thought help them understand what was going on, and getting a few scoops in the political arena. I'm a political journalist at heart, but being able to cover the Zuma years and towards the end of the Zuma years and the decisions that led to the Zuma years for me in terms of writing, explaining why Van Rooyen, for example, when I broke the story of the Des Van Rooyen appointment and the 4 days and how dramatic they were. And also I've been looking at the other stories that are being broke again by colleagues, like Karima Brown, and why Nhlanhla Nene was going to be fired, and just enjoying telling the dramatic story and the impact on the economy, and why Jacob Zuma wasn't going to survive having acted in such a brazen and irrational manner for long. And just I couldn't really get to the bottom of it all, but it was an exciting part of our history to chronicle. Mm-hmm. I'd still like to go back to that, and also the whole state capture thing, and how it came about, and how really we were complicit in some ways. It was the science were there, but also how we contributed to blocking the nuclear deal, and as a media industry, and how we also contributed just to get South Africans to appreciate and how bad the Zuma situation, administration
being aware was. Of the rot.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose for me, in that, you know, in that sort of picture that you're painting, it still then amazes me that A, Cyril Ramaphosa really sneaked in to become Secretary General of the ANC and subsequently President of the country. It wasn't like he had a sort of massive majority of votes. And B, that there still seems to be an ongoing fight. There's a lot of talk about unity, and unity is this, and we are the ANC, and bloody, bloody, blah. But there's actually quite a serious struggle still going on inside the ANC, and I'm just wondering how you analyze that. Is it just money? Because it doesn't seem to be an ideological struggle. What is it?
Now, the ANC has not had an ideological struggle in a long time, if it ever did. I mean, we tend to attribute a lot of things and great things to the history of the ANC, for example, non-racialism, and we tend to think it was something that was naturally aligned with the ANC, when it took the ANC decades discussing whether or not white people can be members of the ANC, and then they agreed in 1969 that, more or that they can be members of the ANC, but then it took them until 1985 for white people to become members, to be eligible to become members of the National Executive Committee, and then when you could have people like your Joe Slovos and people like your Ruth Fest, and people who could still ask questions and whether and the ANC could have white people being members of this great party that it was at the time. So you come to the recent era and the things that have happened in the different stages of the battles around Mbeki. They claimed it was the economics, and he was a neoliberal president, whatever that meant, in the 1996 class project. And the people who criticized Mbeki's economics and economic policies came in. They didn't touch one single policy that Mbeki had in place. Instead, they just dumped everything, and they went to introduce a great scheme of corruption. That's what they did. They realized, what's the ideology behind it all? And then you got Cyril Ramaphosa, as you say, he scraped through. I mean, I was watching him when the results were announced in Mangaung, and okay, he got the nod, and you could see, I mean, the emotions in him. I mean, you just want to imagine him physically in the whole system when he was sitting on that stage, and just to absorb the moment. I mean, I went to him and to congratulate him, and I say, what do you think Madiba would say about such a moment. And he just smiled and he was feeling it in his really euphoric a moment.
You sense that, yeah.
For him. At the same time, when the dangers were there, he had a deputy that people didn't expect. And in David Mabuza, I mean, David Mabuza's brand of politics is a carbon copy of the Jacob Zuma school of governance and ideology and thinking. Now you've got a Cyril Ramaphosa as the president, you've got a Mandela-esque president, then you've got a Jacob Zuma like a deputy president. And you start thinking, oh, what direction is this?
What does this mean now?
And then he gets an Ace Magashule as the third in command. They're like, wait, what's gonna happen here? So the Ramaphosa presidency was shackled at birth, that it couldn't craft a clear direction from the get-go. This is why you're seeing him talking about economic investment and let's talk about all these things that people are not concerned about. I mean, the ANC hasn't been concerned with the investment in a long time. And they're not going to quibble with him. And they let him travel the world and to look for money. They're not doing a simple thing of closing the leaks in the system and the taps. For example, in the Treasury, they had a chief procurement office that was supposed to oversee the government procurement processes and save money up to 25 billion rands a year. Now, Mr. Ramaphosa is on his drive to bring in a trillion rands in new investment in 5 years. We are licking a trillion rands in investment domestically and through the government processes. And so they're not going to worry about all those high ideals of economic talk.
It's like the taps running and the plugs open at the same time.
That's where we are. And I think the ANC has postponed key debates within itself and about itself, where it is and where it's going. And South Africans have also allowed it to do that. And South Africans have done the very same thing and postponing things because Zuma was the great scapegoat. As guilty as he was of a bad leadership, and we sort of allowed ourselves to think that Zuma was the beginning and then the end of a bad...
The be-all and end-all of the problem.
Yeah.
Once he goes, it's all sorted out. That's not the case.
In the coming election, I mean, the ANC is going to be rewarded handsomely from distancing itself with what the people think is the problem, when it wasn't. The problem was just a symptom of that. And the ANC and Ramaphosa has not been able to attract a single professional who was not an ANC member in NASREC to come on board in a significant manner to play an important role in almost 2 years. It has not positioned itself as a party that is thinking about becoming a modern party that could attract people who have a strong commitment to these values about South Africa, fighting corruption.
Sort of technocrats, bureaucrats.
They're not coming through. The people who are there, who are seen as the modernists and the people who are fighting corruption, they were there before NASREC already. Some of them are coming through. But you're still seeing the rogues and people from the rogue gallery and still playing around the ANC at a very high level. Now you have to imagine what's going on at the branch level. The branch exists solely for to fight the electoral battles. And so the ANC will carry on being the ANC that is really shackled by all its problems. And that this hope that Ramaphosa will get a strong mandate to reform the state and then things will change. I mean, we live in hope. But we have to be realistic about it, and you have to look at the obstacles and why this regeneration might not happen. This thing is all pinned on the economics part of the puzzle, that South Africa needs to grow at a faster rate so that we can sell the things we produce and create more jobs. And the unemployment level at 27% is so high that even if we were to double the rate of economic growth, we're still not going to make a dent. Even if we created a million jobs, you'd find that there would be more Xolanis and Janes who are not benefiting out of it. And so we need serious a change in culture and serious institutional change in the setups that we have. And we have serious structural change in the economy. We're not having that conversation. Understand for Mr. Ramaphosa, there would be the hierarchy of of our priorities, as we spoke about earlier. But you don't want that to be the end of it. You want society to be having a better kind of debate around where we are and how do we hold Mr. Ramaphosa accountable. He shouldn't be surprised. He was part of the system that helped Jacob Zuma stay in power for so long. He gave him a veneer of credibility and legitimacy, respectability, when he was happy to be his deputy president in 2012, Mangaung, and he hailed him as this great guy. And that's what he said, and I was so shocked. Really? Jacob Zuma is the boss and he's going to implement the National Development Plan and he's going to do all of this. Okay, I understand the realism around politics, that politicians say this and,
say,
and then they mean it. But Mr. Ramaphosa comes from the broken ANC. And so we should be more mindful, just a bit more critical at looking at the kind of animal that is going into this the coming election and what it really stands for. And the amount of work that has to be done, one, to crank up the election, the economy, and the other one is to steer the vehicle that is the ANC and modernize it and make it, not just make it modern, but to change and actually to the values in the system and the cultural and the political setup of the ANC. That's a lot, really, work that's going to take 3-4 decades.
Let's just go back a little bit to the... Well, okay, we have that. I'll want to just touch on a couple more things now. One of the things that strikes me, or has struck me even now, as we go into the final stages of the election cycle, is the major opposition parties' inability to somehow make a breakthrough themselves by offering something that resonates with a public that is clearly tired now of the past decades. Of the past decades, looting and failure, I suppose, at sort of so many levels.
Yeah.
So, does that say that the ANC will just govern forever? I mean, what would it take for this country to turn against the ANC, given the sort of platter that the opposition parties were given over the last couple of years and still failed to kind of make a significant breakthrough in terms of their support or their even their policy platforms?
Yeah. Look, the thing is with the where we are as a nation. I mean, we've got this history which is both a blessing and a curse of having lived through this colonialism, apartheid, and then the resistance to that operation through the liberation strand of our politics. So that sort of, when you look at the some examples across the African continent of liberation parties and how they able to regenerate their hegemony despite their well-documented inability to govern in democratic times. So in South Africa, we've got there's a brutal history of apartheid and this blessing of what the ANC and many people did to fight for democracy. So that makes some people in society cling on to the idea of the ANC and also the fear of a life without that the idea they have in their mind of the ANC. But we've seen in some examples, though, that South Africa might not be a perfect example of the society post colonialism and oppression, in that the ANC has been able to lose its hegemony in society. It's lost that. It's no longer the leader of society. It can't organize a million people out into the streets on any cause for that matter. I know that a ruling party should be doing at that. So it's lost its legitimacy in so many ways, but people still vote for the idea, some of them, and the sense of belonging. And also the absence of a realistic ideas and a movement and a party to oppose the ANC. I mean, you've seen the DA changing here and there, but it sort of straddles the old DA and also the old South Africa being opposed to all, because they come from the history of the PFP and the Democratic Party that was not quite with the opposition, the National Party, or what apartheid was all about. And then it comes to the new South Africa, and it talks of a South Africa and South Africa for all, and we're all equal, and race doesn't matter. And then opportunistically, race matters, and manufactures these young leaders who wouldn't lead anywhere else, put them on this pedestal, and they're supposed to lead, and they don't really have the skills or the experience, and also they're not able to articulate a vision of a South Africa. And that vision needs to not just straddle the difficult history and also the great dream of a new South Africa. It must transcend it. It must be a vision, and that it really captures people that we are bigger than just our history, and this is what we can do. And they must actually be looking at the globally at the great examples of watch how vulnerable liberation parties can be. I mean, India is a great example where we saw the ANC matches itself with the party of Gandhi in India, the Congress Party. Congress Party was wiped away. It lost an election, and funny enough, Jacob Zuma was in India during that election. I'm thinking, nobody's watching the examples, and it's happening right. Well, he's on a state visit to India, and nobody's taking notes on how liberation parties lose their legitimacy and eventually get wiped out. So it's still very possible for the ANC to lose control. There are other examples in South America and Mexico, the pre-party, after 72 years in government, it lost power and it went back to the opposition ranks and brought itself back onto power. So I don't think that the main opposition party, the DA, sort of understand those nuances about what is it that they are opposed to. They are opposed to corruption, but they don't study the terrain of your opposition is a liberation movement. It wants to remain that as well, and to create this facade around itself as not just a political party that is after political power and the spoils of political power. So if you want to take on the ANC, you need to understand the animal that the ANC, and it remains very vulnerable. It has postponed its absolute terminal decline in NASREC, but whether they're able to regenerate that and really use that opportunity to recreate the ANC in a very, very sustainable way, I have serious doubts about that. And also, I mean, the other things is how South Africans relate to democracy and understanding classically what democracy is. Democracy deepens and it becomes better when there's a competitive elections. So people need to be taught and to understand a bit better. Many scholars have looked at the 20-year mark and that democracies and parties lose their way after 20 years in governance. I mean, the ANC lost its way before that. It's been proven it cannot govern. But for the democratic system itself, we need to look at beyond that. For democracy to be a real democracy, a party must lose power. When it loses power, it must boot it out of government. Democratically, it must use democratic means to fight back for that power. Then you can say you have a real democracy. Until you've experienced a very peaceful change of power, and then you see that power being lost and regained through democratic means, you haven't experienced true democracy. We haven't tested our democracy entirely to make sure that it's stress tested and it can withstand that. So we have changes within the same mold of the same party and carrying on and ticking over. We haven't experienced a true competitive national election. I mean, you can see the ANC losing power in these great metros and the implications of that. One, the sky hasn't fallen and people are living now under the control of the Democratic Alliance. Yet we were told before that if you let the white men govern you, this is what they're going to bring. They're going to bring back apartheid and all of that. I mean, we live in Johannesburg. We've got a mayor, Mashaba. We're the mayor, Parkstow. We can critique them for their performance and how their administrations I have done. But we need to get beyond the scarecrow type of politics that if the ANC were to lose power...
It's all going to hell then.
But we've had hell under the ANC. We've had a Jacob Zuma giving power to people who don't live in South Africa, people who are not South Africans in the true sense of the word, where the ANC was privatized to a gang. And this is a mob that looted, that didn't respect the basic elements and symbols of our nation, who can land in a national key point at the Vatere Kloof, who could do far worse things to insult this republic and behave like South Africa is a democratic republic. What more must happen for us to realize that the ANC is no longer what it was? We were governed by something other than the ANC. But also, we have to see ourselves as something bigger than just other victims of a system, a weak system. And we need to talk about how do we strengthen the system so that we can presidential elections, not just the current system which we have. Parliament was very responsible in abating the Zuma system. It allowed him to get away with a whole lot of things, as it allowed the Mbeki administration. So we have to talk about ways to empower Parliament to act as the constitution allows it, at least on paper.
Mm. Just to close, looking ahead to the election now, what are the challenges, do you think, facing the press in the build-up to the election, and how is it in this sort of environment of fake news and social media and politicking at a very sort of sophisticated level? What are the challenges facing journalists who are trying to report now on the election, and how do you think they should sort of mitigate against being caught up or being played? I mean, we've had examples of reporters, sort of quite respected names. I mean, that Sunday Times and the Rogue Unit thing, I'm not exactly quite clear what happened there, but, you know, it seems that the press itself has to be so much more careful in an environment where any kind of slip-up can be used to question the legitimacy of the media in this country?
Great question. Jeez, where do I start answering that? Wish I could turn the tables. I'm used to asking these questions. And the problems are so vast and so sophisticated, I don't think we fully comprehend the problems are facing us going into this election. I mean, there's these issues you are alluding to, and they in the realm of fake news and sophisticated attempts to steer journalists away from facts and truth and into becoming instruments of propaganda and propaganda machines and machines to spread deliberate lies. And we saw the Trump administration rise in the U.S. on the back of a very careful and choreographed propaganda machine. And there's some elements of that in South Africa. I mean, we just recently dealt with the Bell Pottinger scandal in South Africa, how the social media was used as a weapon to muddy the waters and also to intimidate a journalist. And we saw bots used to spread and to amplify lies. And the residue of all that the Bell Pottinger infrastructure is still at work. That's a serious concern for me and a couple other people in the industry going into this election, that how do South Africans tell the difference between legitimate news and legitimate information that may be coming through various ways and of spreading information? I mean, we live in an era now where everybody is their own reporter and editor, and they can tweet information, sometimes authentic information, sometimes not. So it's going to be very difficult for people to decide who to follow and who not to. And then this happens at the same time the industry is facing serious questions about its credibility and legitimacy. I mean, the Sunday Times is just a painful episode and what it had to deal with the spy rogue unit issues. And so there are legitimate questions about us and how we carry ourselves. And there's then broadly the issue of fake news and people who have websites and to spread news, and they take advertising for it and to swindle really money out of corporates, and who are not careful enough in choosing who to be associated with and where to advertise. So that also concerns us. And but the biggest threat for me is this organized schemes and to distort information. And some political parties, and they're really, really sailing close to the wind in terms of some of these areas and their own operations. I mean, the ANC had its own dark arts scandal 2 years ago.
Yes. The war room.
And also, I mean, the EFF as well has got unorthodox ways of communicating information and on social media. And sometimes you worry about who retweets them and how they work. And think, wait, this doesn't, you know, it's just a fluke that this a message like this could go so viral. And I just wonder if our leaders are even aware of some of these things. And so people will be duped into the dark side of things going into the election. And also the ability of the Independent Electoral Commission to police this and manage this game. Because they are the referees in this game, and it's going to be very difficult. And I really feel for the South African who has to now decide and what's legitimate and what is. There are very easy ways around it and stick with the trusted press, but which is the trusted press? Mm. This is now the bigger one. And there's also attempts to domesticate the SABC, and those will never stop. And the SABC is a powerful instrument. That's a mechanism and ability to reach far-flung corners.
Radio stations, multilingual. I mean, it's potent.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, we are in murky waters and choppy season.
Sam, thanks so much for your time this morning. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I wish you all the best with your next adventures.
Thank you so much, Jack. I really appreciate it.
That was pretty intense. I hope you enjoyed that. You can hear sort of the passion he has for his craft, and also I think the despair he feels, the disappointment he feels, the state of the ANC today. I mean, when he said, you know, the ANC had privatized itself to a gang, I mean, that's quite something to say. But also, you know, when he mentioned that need for South Africa to test its democracy and what that entails in a peaceful changeover or handing over, loss of power and regaining of power by democratic means. So, yeah, perhaps a long way to go in our democratic journey. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. Please also subscribe via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.